And thanks so much for tuning in. Coming up next will be Ecologic, produced by Ken Gale, Sally Gellert, and Donna Stein. That's next at 10 a.m. over listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web.
A parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on prolonging the earth, then tell me where we're gonna plant our seed.
See a windmill go, feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Welcome. Glad you could join us for Ecologic. Clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein, and this is Ecologic for Wednesday, September 27th, 2023. Sally Gellert is at a Farm Bill conference and will be back with us next week.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Today we'll be talking with Arjun Makhijani, PhD of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and Gordon Edwards, PhD of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. But first, victory at the California Water Board, an analysis of ecofascism and what gives products their fragrance.
Good news. Victory over Nestle. The Crunch Nestle campaign from 2014 finally got results. When a corporation signs a contract to remove water, they rarely, if ever, take things like droughts and water shortages into effect. California has been suffering through water shortages for years. Despite activist appeals, Nestle Water North America, which later became Blue Triton, had been bottling water without limitation. Just last week, the people of California won. The California State Water Board approved a cease and desist order that will stop the company from removing tens of millions of gallons of water annually from Southern California's San Bernardino National Forest. The fight isn't over. Tunnels, boreholes, and pipelines that have been for decades been sucking water out of the severely drought-impacted area still need to be removed. Environmentalists are also asking the Water Board to impose maximum fines for decades-long removal of water without a valid right. But this is still a victory and could be a precedent-setting win to stop water removal in other states such as Michigan and Maine. Congratulations to Andy Kahn and the Crunch Nestle team.
We'd like to think of all environmentalists as good people supporting a healthy planet for all. However, sometimes that interest goes to extremes, or through worry that solving our deep environmental problems is impossible, turns selfish and aggressive. Sometimes it's not sincere at all. Ecofascism supports violence and labels some people unworthy of sharing a healthy environment, blaming others for causing the problems affecting their group. That is when things get dark, when people buy into both myths of scarcity and misanthropy. That's hatred of humans That is when environmentalism can turn to eco-fascism, a selfish, nationalistic, and racist perversion of environmentalism. Eco-fascism is also a way for out-and-out fascists to pretend that they care about more than their own prosperity and privilege, that they care about open space, wildlife, and healthy environment. The catch is the insincerity that they use images of a cleaner, greener earth to hide their desire to wipe out all of those who don't fit into their exclusive vision. We on Ecologic and WBI have no patience or respect with ecofascists of any stripe.
To me, ecofascism is use of environmentalist language by fascists and other ultra-conservatives for their own ends, hoping to mislead people away from true environmentalism into the ecofascist path. The polluters have gotten good through years of practice at using environmental language. They create front groups with environmental-sounding names. They have people who work for them join environmental groups and be active on their e-lists as part of their job. Activism isn't the antidote for despair. Infiltrators and eco-fascists will play on despair to keep as many individuals as they can from becoming active or educated on issues beyond a superficial understanding. Eco-fascists play divide and conquer politics, using the language of separation to keep different groups of people from working together.
Ecologic Collective member, contributor, Tim Keating is the first person who comes to my mind when thinking about recycling, environmental hazards, sustainability, and wouldn't forest anything. Tim shared an article from EWG, the Environmental Working Group, about those delightful fragrances that we have all around us. Not. According to the International Fragrance Association, fragrance, quote unquote, is made up of a mix of more than 3,500 chemicals to give personal care, cleaning, and other products a unique smell. Some fragrance ingredients are toxic chemicals. Manufacturers aren't required to list fragrance ingredients on product labels, even though exposure to some of these substances can lead to a wide range of health problems. Some fragrance allergens will have to be disclosed under a December 22nd federal law, but the Food and Drug Administration has not yet released a list of allergens that must be disclosed, and the requirements will not go into effect until at least 2025. Many of us love our eau de parfume or cologne products, worn solely for the aroma, but a wide range of other products is under too. Take your pick. Maybe you use rosemary shampoo, lavender hand cream, or citrus-smelling household cleaner, for instance. Some of the scents in these products originate in nature. Those are good ones. But most are the result of a combination of synthetic chemicals, sometimes hundreds of them. These chemicals are often considered a trade secret, so instead of being listed separately, they are simply grouped under umbrella words such as fragrance, perfume, or parfum, or aroma. The Environmental Working Group evaluates consumer products for potential health products, and products bearing the EWG verified mark are free from their chemicals of concern and meet EWG standards for transparency and health.
And now we welcome our guests, Arjun Makhijani and Gordon Edwards. Please introduce yourself. Arjun?
I'm Arjun Makhijani. I'm at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, which is dedicated to providing good science to the public and policymakers and frontline communities and the democratization of science. Done a lot of work on radiation-related issues going back over 40 years.
And Gordon?
Hi, I'm Gordon Edwards. I'm the president and co-founder of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, located, headquartered here in Montreal, Canada. And we've been involved for 40 years and more on trying to bring insight into a subject which is largely mystified. There's a lot of mystification that is brought about by the industry and by the regulator even. And we try to cut through that and express the scientific facts in simple language that is understandable to people without talking down to them, but just simply lifting them up into the realm of understanding. Because without understanding, it's very difficult to cope with this issue.
Gordon Edwards has a wonderful slideshow about radiation and the basics of it, how it affects you, where it comes from. Wonderful slideshow. And Arjun Makhijani has an incredible book on tritium. And reading it brought me back to my early days in the anti-nuclear movement, reading John Goffman's book. I do not compare anyone to John Goffman lightly. John Goffman is, he was part of the Manhattan Project. He was a co-discoverer of uranium 233, something they didn't even know it existed until he and somebody else found it. And then he didn't like what radiation was doing to people, so he became a medical doctor so he could explain and educate better. That's the kind of person I am comparing Arjun to. Oh. The book Exploring Tritium Dangers, Arjun made it available to WBAI, so we have it as a premium. It's a $45 pledge to get that book. It's beautifully written in plain English in the beginning of the book, and then you get into the real hard science toward the end of the book. But by then you've got a grounding in what, and it's not just about tritium. I know it's called Exploring Tritium Dangers, but it's about radiation and what it does to our bodies. A whole chapter on pregnancy.
So let's just go to basics, all right? Because a lot of people don't even know what tritium is. A lot of people don't even know what the dangers of radioactivity is, but that's another, that's beyond. I was with a friend the other day who didn't know anything about the harms of radioactivity and tritium and what's that and whatever. So let's just go to basics. You want to go take a stab at that, Gordon? What is tritium and why is it such a big deal?
Yeah, I think it's really important to distinguish between radiation and radioactivity. Radiation is, it includes harmful radiation and non-harmful radiation. You know, there's all kinds of radiation. There's a spectrum of radiation. And it's only at the very energetic level of the spectrum. And when you get into X-rays and gamma rays, that you actually have breaking of chemical bonds, damage to DNA molecules directly, and so on. That's called ionizing radiation. But radioactivity is something else, because radioactivity, unlike a lot of radiation, you can shut it off, like an X-ray machine. You shut it off, it's harmless. Radioactivity cannot be shut off. And this is why we have a radioactive waste problem. Now, tritium is a radioactive material, and there's many, many other radioactive materials. The thing that distinguishes radioactive materials, and think of them as materials, not invisible rays, these are materials which have atoms that explode. They disintegrate suddenly. And it's at the moment of disintegration, they give off a kind of a shrapnel, a subatomic shrapnel, which is called atomic radiation. And those are actually particles, not rays, although there is also a gamma ray which is given off, but there's alpha particles and beta particles, and they damage directly the cells, the living cells of any kind. And it's because you can't turn these little disintegrating atoms, you can't neutralize them, you got to keep them out of the environment. If you keep them out of the environment, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, then they're not going to get into your body. If you don't come, you have to have shielding against gamma rays, but there are other types of rays, alpha and beta, which only do their harm when they get inside your body. And that's the case with tritium. Tritium is harmless outside the body, but once it gets inside, it can actually be incorporated into your organic molecules. And water goes everywhere. All living things depend upon water. And tritium is radioactive hydrogen, which forms radioactive water molecules as well as radioactive carbon molecules. So that's why it's particularly dangerous, because we're carbon-based life forms.
Okay. And
Arjun, add to that?
Yeah, one of the reasons I wrote this book, Exploring Tritium Dangers, is the way tritium's being generally considered in terms of radioactive hazards is exactly because it combines with oxygen and makes radioactive water. And since we pass water through our systems relatively rapidly, so for instance, in the nuclear weapons establishment, if somebody got a tritium exposure, they'd give them a six-pack of beer or tell them to drink more coffee. But there's some scientific basis to that. You pass it through your body faster, so you get a lesser radiation dose. What hasn't happened is looking at other aspects of damage than cancer to grown-ups. And that's why I wrote this book. So because tritium gets into every cell, cytoplasm, which is most of the cell, is mostly water. It ionizes the water. It breaks it up into very reactive pieces. One of those pieces is the hydroxyl radical. It's extremely reactive, and it damages the mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondria are little remnants of bacteria. We have hundreds to thousands of them in every cell, and they are what makes your heart beat. They are what makes your arms move the way I'm doing it. They are what makes your eyes go. So they are the energy engine of the body. They convert the food into into molecules that can be that can give you mechanical energy. The mitochondrial DNA doesn't have as much repair mechanism as the nuclear DNA, the one we talk about, the double helix. This is not the double helix. This has its own circular DNA, hundreds of them in every cell. And they don't have the repair mechanism, but they're the energy system of the body. That's one thing. And the other thing is, early in pregnancy, if the embryo is damaged, you can have early failed pregnancies, you can have malformations. For certain malformations involving the central nervous system, there's no dose below which the risk of that damage is zero. All of that has been ignored. We asked the National Academies in 1999 to pay attention. They said, yeah, okay, we will. And then they published the report and they said, maybe some other time. I mean, those are not the exact words, but, and that was in 2006, and I'm still waiting. And so part of the push to the establishment to pay attention to pregnant women, to pay attention to fetal health. We talk so much about that. When does life begin? All that. I'm saying, okay, then why aren't we paying attention to the dangers of tritium and other radionuclides that cross the placenta?
It could be because there is a company narrative that everybody hears in the mass media that, tritium, it's a 12-year half-life, big deal. And I've spoken to very intelligent people who actually buy into that and think it's no big deal. It's that not realizing that half-life means half and half and half and half. By the time you're done, it's 144 years or whatever. But, so it's a company narrative that we have to really be careful of, and why people are not knowing and not caring and putting it off.
Well, okay, we know how dangerous tritium is and how dangerous, ionizing radiation is. Where does it come from?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's both man-made tritium and nature-made tritium. There is a certain amount of tritium that is created, has been for millions of years in the upper atmosphere by cosmic radiation. And this comes to Earth and causes a certain amount of tritium in the environment. However, when we talk about the tritium from the Pilgrim plant, or when we talk about tritium from the Indian Point plant, we're talking about human-made tritium. The nuclear reactors mass produce tritium in large amounts. And the way they do that is by activating non-radioactive materials. Again, I want to distinguish between radioactive materials, which are exploding atoms, and non-radioactive materials, which are not exploding, never explode. So they're fundamentally different, and yet they behave identically. If you have radioactive hydrogen and non-radioactive hydrogen, they behave the same way chemically. They enter the same combinations. They go into your body the same way, go to the same organs, go to the fetus, for example, except that these atoms are exploding and causing random damage. And that triggers cancers and other kinds of diseases. So This stuff is man-made and human-made, and it gets out into the environment in large amounts. We heard recently about Japan dumping a huge amount of tritium into the Pacific Ocean. Well, that goes on around the world from nuclear plants of all kinds all the time, actually.
And Arjun, you talk about the above-ground nuclear tests, and that made tritium that's still with us?
Well, some of it is still with us. Most above-ground nuclear tests stopped in 1963 with the U.S., Soviet, British partial test ban treaty. But France continued into the 70s and China until 1980, which is when the last atmospheric test was. So most of the tritium is gone. Then what happens? Because it becomes water, it evaporates with the regular water, comes down as rain. So by now, the tritium from testing is very dilute. So let me give you some numbers. In rivers, your tritium will be, should I talk in American units? Yeah, 25, 30 picocuries per liter, about one becquerel per liter. In the oceans, it's 1/10 of a becquerel per liter, so 1/10 of that. What Japan will be dumping into the Pacific Ocean as their upper limit of tritiated water is 1,500, so 15,000 times the ocean concentration. So it will make a difference to the creatures that are living in the bottom of the sea. It's the same tritium that's human-made and natural-made. It's the concentrations that are different. And a thing I'd like to say is, if Mother Nature does something to you, it doesn't give your neighbor. So Mother Nature will, you know, gives us birth and we will all die. And dying is often a pretty painful process. But if your neighbor comes up to you and says, Mother Nature is going to harm you, you know, you'll hurt a lot when you die, let me punch you in the nose, you would say, no, it's a much smaller dose. No. You don't let your neighbor punch you in the nose unless you invite him to teach you boxing or something. But so the whole idea that, you know, there's so much natural tritium, so we can dump too, is philosophically and morally completely wrong. That's why in the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency regulations, it says if you're going to introduce some harms, you should calculate the benefits, and the benefits should exceed the harms. Well, most people in the Pacific region will get no benefits, right. So the thing is not justified. We've been pointing this out again and again and again. And the International Atomic Energy Agency said, well, we're not going to consider that part of our regulation in evaluating this because the harms will be negligible.
Yeah, and it's important to realize that although they talk about naturally occurring radiation, and that's true, there's naturally occurring radioactivity in the world. However, that kills people. There's thousands of people dying every year just as a result of breathing radon gas in their own homes. That's natural radon gas, but it doesn't mean it's harmless. Arsenic is natural. It's not harmless. Mercury is natural. It's not harmless. So this is a false comparison, saying that because it's natural, it's fine. It's not true. Natural radioactivity kills a lot of people, and human-made radioactivity has the potential to accelerate that many thousands, even millions of times if it were not contained. The most important thing is to contain this material and keep it out of the environment. When the industry dumps tritium into the environment, basically they're saying it's no longer our problem, it's your problem. And the trouble is, it's the thin edge of the wedge. If they're allowed to dump tritium, what comes next? And they're going to want to more and more disseminate their radioactive waste materials into various forms of environmental disposal so that they can draw the line and say it's no longer our problem. We have to really, as a society, put our foot down and say, no, this is not permissible. You're not allowed to do that.
Yeah. The other thing I'd just like to append to what Gordon just said is, what Japan is dumping, and they have started dumping, is not just tritium, tritiated water. The traces of other radionuclides, which per unit of radioactivity are a lot more harmful, strontium-90, cesium-137, in the tanks where there's more than a million tons of water, there's even some plutonium, there are sludges, there's cobalt-60.
And what they haven't done is done the science properly to see what this will do to the ecosystems. And I'm part of an expert panel advising the Pacific region countries on this matter. And a couple of our people are ocean scientists. And they've said, look, cobalt-60 will concentrate in the bottom sediments more than 300,000 times. And you haven't considered that. Well, you know, so they haven't done the science before they've said it's going to be all right.
Unbelievable. Excuses, Arjun and Gordon, as we need to take a short break.
You're listening to Ecologic, WBAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. We'll be back with our guests, Arjun Makhijani and Gordon Edwards, in a few minutes. WBAI is listener-sponsored, listener-supported, and listeners often forget to donate unless asked.
And we'll gladly send you Arjun's book, Exploring Tritium Dangers, when you help us with a gift of $45.
Let's call this a WBAI rent party. Donate for your copy of Exploring Tritium Dangers. We've needed a book like Exploring Tritium Dangers for a long time. It's the only book of its kind, and with the risk of tritium being dumped in the Hudson River, we all need to learn all we can about the possible health effects of this radioactive substance. Isn't it worth $45 to know something this important? Call 212-209-2950 to get your copy of Exploring Tritium Dangers and become a member of WBAI at the same time. That membership alone is a $25 value.
It's great spending the whole show with Arjun Makhijani and Gordon Edwards, and we'll be continuing soon.
Did you become a BAI member by June 30th? Time is running out to vote in the current election. There are just a few days left. Ballots must be cast before midnight on Saturday, September 30th, and we need all our eligible members to participate. Please, it is very important that we get a quorum. Is your vote missing? If we don't get a quorum, the election process will have to be extended, and that means more money spent on running the election, money lost to programming, transmission, payroll, utilities, all the needs of a running station. If you didn't get a ballot, request one on elections.pacifica.org. That's elections.pacifica.org. You can view candidates there, too. If you don't have access to the Internet, leave a message at 213-635-9363. That's 213-635-9363. Voting now is as vital to saving the station as were all the efforts in October 2019 when the station was shut down without notice by a rogue faction of Pacifica. We have very little time and really need to make that quorum by Saturday so that if we can move on without extra cost. Find your ballot and vote today, please.
There is more information in Dr. Makhijani's book than we can possibly fit into a one-hour show. Dr. Makhijani writes in plain English, though there is a lot of science in the book. Have you been enjoying the conversation with Dr. Makhijani and Dr. Edwards? Wouldn't you like to take this info home with you? The next best thing to them being with you is Dr. Makhijani's book, Exploring Tritium Dangers, a $45 donation.
If you want, you can send a check or money order for your membership and our premiums. Mail to WBAI Radio, Attention Membership, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. That's 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, 11217.
And here is Creative Native's live cover of the New Zealand reggae band Herb's song, Nuclear Waste.
Unemployment is all around.
Nuclear Waste is Coming Down. That was Nuclear Waste by Herbs, covered by Creative Natives.
You're listening to Ecologic, WBAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Donna Stein.
And I'm Ken Gale. We're back with Arjun Makajani and Gordon Edwards. And we alluded briefly in the first half about the effect of radioactivity on pregnancy. And well, let's talk about that in greater detail. We'll start with you, Arjun.
Yeah. So let me relate some of the evidence where that comes from. So on first principles, knowing what ionizing radioactivity is, the one that splits apart molecules, we can infer a lot of things, but there's also epidemiological evidence. Now, epidemiological evidence appears only when there's a certain number of problem outcomes, like cancers or other diseases. At a lower levels, you don't really see it. So it's significant whenever you see epidemiological evidence, you know, surveying populations for health problems. So the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have been one of the primary populations for understanding the impacts of radiation. And there were women who were pregnant at the time of the bombings. Now, some of those pregnancies actually went to term and those children were born. Not all, of course. And those children were medically followed up for problems. One of the problems that was found was what is called in the official medical reports severe mental retardation. That may not be politically the most appropriate word today, but that's what is in the documents. And it's described as people who can't speak properly and who cannot take care of their bodily functions, so who need continuing medical care for their lives. Right. And it was found that this kind of damage during pregnancy occurs with no threshold. That is, a small amount of radioactivity exposure during pregnancy will create a small risk of these severe neurological outcomes. And this has been known since the 1980s in official publications, International Commission on Radiological Protection, which are sort of the standard global official references for radiation impacts. Yet we have no protections for pregnant women at all in the general population. The only pregnancies that are protected in terms of limiting dose are in the nuclear workplaces, like in nuclear reactors. And their fetuses are limited to 500 millirem, which is 5 millisieverts, which is 5 times the annual dose allowed to the general population. That's the standard in the United States. I think it's stricter in Canada. But even so, fetal doses equal to the general population is an outrageously loose standard. And the vast majority of women are not even protected by that. And we've been asking for protections of this kind and for children, especially for, as I've said before, in the first part of the show, for 25 years of the National Academies, and they haven't yet agreed even to study it. Hmm. So there's actual evidence. So how much radiation crosses the placenta, that's also been studied. It's in ICRP publications. So in the case of tritium, for example, the fetus will have a greater concentration of tritium because of how the flows across the placenta work than the mother. If the mother is exposed to plutonium or cesium or strontium before pregnancy, that will remain in her body, and that will cross the placenta. So even exposure before pregnancy of radionuclides inside the body affects the fetus. So it's not just exposure during the pregnancy. And despite all of that, essentially, it's very weird. Let me say one last thing. Is in the 50s and early 60s,
the impacts on children were being considered. You know, like these children were being followed up at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and so on. But when at the end of the 50s, the general public started becoming the focus of special radiation protection regulations apart from workers, somehow consideration of children in radiation studies seems to have disappeared for about 20 years. Wow. Until the 1990s. Now, we know children are much more impacted per unit of dose, girl children more than boy children, but all children more than adults.
Gordon?
Yeah, I want to point out something very important here, and that is that tritium, of all the radioactive materials that are released in various quantities, tritium is released in the greatest quantity because we don't know how to screen it out. We have no way of removing tritium from contaminated water. The reason is that the tritiated molecules are chemically identical to ordinary water molecules, and you can't filter water from water. So nobody can have a water purification system in their home or in their municipality that removes the tritium from the water. Now, other radioactive materials can often be removed because of their chemical characteristics, not so with tritium. And of course, similarly, when the mother gets the tritium, it goes easily and directly into the fetus, as suggested. This has been shown very clearly in animal experiments. And indeed, as Arjun has just said, the embryo gets a larger dose than the mother when the mother is exposed to ingesting tritiated water. One other thing I want to mention is that women, especially with tritium, but this is also true with other forms of radioactive materials, women are approximately twice as affected as men. And this is because women have a larger larger amount of body fat, naturally speaking, because of their motherly nature, statistically saying. And so they store roughly twice as much tritium as men would. Another thing that's important to remember is that when a baby girl is born, all the eggs that she will have in her whole life are right there at the very beginning. And if those eggs are exposed to tritium damage at that time, that damage is going to be carried throughout her life. So that a baby child born with tritium damage to the eggs can result in giving birth to defective infants many decades later. So this is a very serious thing. And the fact that tritium is so ubiquitous and so impossible to remove from the environment once it's out there argues very strongly that it should not be released in the first place. If you have a moment, I could tell you one little story, but maybe I should stop here. Should I continue?
Both of you said that you would like to hear from our listeners.
Yeah.
So
let's do that.
Yeah. So call 212-209-2877. Now's your time to call 212-209-2877. And while we're waiting for the listeners to call in, why don't you tell that story?
Well, in Germany, they had 17 nuclear reactors. They've shut them down now. They're all shut down. But they had 17 nuclear reactors operating at the time of Fukushima, and they did a fantastic study, one of the best studies ever done in the world. And they found that children under 5 years old showed an excess of leukemia within 5 miles of any one of those nuclear power plants. They found that it was true of the whole bunch of power plants, but they removed one power plant after the other from the study, and they found that they got the same results every single time. And they said at the time that it could not be due to radiation or radioactivity because they couldn't see how it could happen. But Ian Fairley, who is an expert on tritium in the UK, Canadian originally, he said, you know, it could very well be because of the tritium releases. Because we know that if babies are showing leukemia before the age of 5, they must have been exposed in the womb. And to be exposed in the womb to radioactive materials, tritium would be the most obvious choice. So although this is not universally recognized by the scientific community, it's the only logical explanation that I have seen offered that makes sense.
Wow. 212-209-2800 and call to talk to Arjun and Gordon.
And while we're waiting for your call, we are glad to announce the EcoWatch.com article that the white and black rhino populations have increased for the first time since 2012. They were both pretty small groups, So it didn't take much to see an increase, but it's nice reversal of a horrible trend. And we want to thank Alfred Meyer for introducing us to Arjun.
Thank you, Alfred.
So, I wanted to mention Arjun dedicated or had a sponsor of this book by Kay Dry, who is an absolutely wonderful activist. And I'm happy for anybody who gets to meet her. I mean, she's so amazing. And reading the book, I'm going, yep, I can see why Kay would like this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We she calls tritium her favorite radionuclide. It's on her car license plate.
Oh, no.
Yeah, she's a good friend and a wonderful philanthropist and a lovely, lovely person, and has been fighting nuclear power and radioactive contamination for many decades.
And when I was writing Chernobyl on the Hudson, a lot of my research came from her.
Yeah, she's an amazing person.
I met her and I said I was doing research on routine emissions of radiation from nuclear power plants because nobody else seemed to be doing it at the time. Mm. And she was so happy that somebody else felt the same way and let me go into her research. And I ended up using that research to write Chernobyl on the Hudson. Right,
yeah, she has quite a library in her basement.
Oh boy, and she has it. It's like card catalog, kind of.
And I'd just like to make a correction here. The phone number to call in with your questions is 212-209-2877. 2877. 212-209-2877.
And we do have a caller. So you are on the air. Welcome to Ecologic.
Hello. You guess that's me, huh?
Yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate the elaboration on what the difference between radiation and radioactivity is, but I'd like to see if you guys can explain on the atomic level what the difference between tritium, can I call it a tritium atom?
Yeah, hydrogen absolutely.
Is. You know, I mean, are there equal numbers of protons? Is there a neutron added or something like that? What's the deal?
Well, I can explain that. A hydrogen atom, hydrogen is the most abundant element in the entire universe. And hydrogen has the simplest possible nucleus. It's only a single proton with a single electron going around it. Now, if you add a neutron to that proton, then you get what's called heavy hydrogen, and that gives rise to heavy water, which is not radioactive. But if you add a second neutron, so you have now one proton and two neutrons with a single electron going around it, this is three times as massive as ordinary hydrogen, but it's radioactive. It's unstable. And it's that instability in the nucleus of the atom. That's where that's why we call it nuclear energy, because it comes from the heart of the atom, which is the nucleus. All other forms of energy do not come from the nucleus. They come from the electrons going around it, the chemical energy. But here we have nuclear energy, and it's much more powerful than any other. It's the most powerful force in the universe, is the energy that holds the atom together. And so when that energy is released, it does, our cells do not have any protection really against it. There's a certain amount of mending that takes place always, healing, but it's limited. And our bodies are not designed, and no animal bodies are designed to detect radioactivity, to screen it out. Because why? We haven't needed to do it. Over the centuries, it's been constant. The amount of radioactivity in the environment is constant. It's only when we invented nuclear fission that we've vastly increased the exposure to radioactive materials. And our bodies are not prepared for that. They cannot cope with it.
212-209-2877, and we have another caller. You're on the line.
Yes, this is Alfred Meyer calling. And
hey.
Hello,
oh, we just mentioned
hello,
you.
Hello, Gordon. Hello, Donna.
Hi.
Hello, Ken.
Hi, Alfred.
Thank you for having this very, very important discussion. I wanted to add one more dimension to it. You certainly have raised the alarms about the threats to public health that we face, but I worry that what's really driving the military, the nuclear enterprise in this country and around the world is the military and its pursuit of nuclear weapons and a nuclear navy with which to deliver them. And that, therefore, with this primacy of the military, I think historically, one question I'd have is, has our understanding of the medical effects of radiation in essence been hijacked in part by the military? But I'd bring this up because if we want to keep things like the dumping of tritium from happening, I think we need to understand what's driving the bus here. Thank you very much.
The military is involved in some radiation research. There's the Armed Forces Radiobiological Research Institute. I think that's the name, or close to it. They've actually done some very good work on depleted uranium after the first Gulf War, when it became a big controversy with the veterans of that war. And we've cited some of that research in a report we did, Science for the Vulnerable. I'll put the link in the chat. The research on radiation is done mostly by committees of the national academies, by the ICRP and so on. So I don't believe that that's controlled by the Pentagon, but that doesn't mean that they've examined all the issues. As I said, we've been trying to convince the national academies to study this issue of pregnancy, radionuclides that cross the placenta for a quarter of a century now and failed. But in terms of certain kinds of radiation, ionizing radiation for external radiation, cancer risk, they've done a pretty good job, I think, in the most recent report. So it's a mixed bag, but mostly I think we're lacking protection of children and protection during pregnancy. Yeah. That's my view.
Yeah, I'd like to add something to this. Many people don't realize, and we haven't mentioned it here, that tritium is also a nuclear explosive. That in the atomic bombs that they make, if they put a little tritium inside the atomic bomb, they can more than double the explosive power of the atomic bomb. And this is because of something called fusion. It doesn't mean that we have an H bomb, but just an ordinary fission bomb can have some boosting from a fusion reaction caused by tritium atoms being put inside the core of the bomb itself. And, they've taken a domestic Tennessee Valley Authority reactors, and they've used it to manufacture tritium specifically for use in the military, so that there is a spillover between the civilian and the military use. Now, I do believe that one thing that has always exasperated me is that it's been known for since the 1970s, early 1970s, that tritium is at least two or three times more biologically damaging than gamma radiation per unit of energy absorbed by tissue. And yet they still treat it as if it's the same, that there's no difference. And I wonder whether the military might have played a role in preventing the proper quality factor or radiation biological effectiveness factor to tritium, because it's the workers who work in the weapons factories that are exposed to tritium in more quantities. And so the military might have played a role in suppressing information about the harmful effects of tritium.
Wow.
So we have one more minute. Could you just please introduce yourselves again and tell us maybe what what you think our listeners can do?
I'll just say my name is Gordon Edwards. I'm Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Our website is easy to find. It's CCNR, Charles Norman Roger, .org.
I'm Arjun Makhijani. I'm with the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER.org, where you can find all kinds of materials. I think it's important to pressure the national academies and the government to address, and the Environmental Protection Agency to address, the issue of children and fetal exposure and protect the public.
And sorry we didn't get time to get to the other callers, but it's time to wrap up. Boy, does this hour go fast. So let's thank Arjun Makhijani and Gordon Edwards for joining us today. For more information, go to IEER.org and CCNR.org. That's IEER.org and CCNR.org. We have lots of links for more information on our website, ecoradio.org. That's ECORADIO.org. We also have an archive of our past shows.
Join us next Wednesday, October 4th at 10 a.m. as we bring you another Celebration of Nature show with biologist Dr. Abby Hafer. This one on animals that are just plain fascinating. To support Ecology, you can donate any amount, but with just $45, you'll become a WBAI member and get Dr. Arjun Makajani's book, Exploring Tritium Danger. And it's a wonderful book. It's more than tritium. It explains everything that you've heard and more. It's a $45 donation, really worth it.
We love to stay in touch with you. So those of you online, please go to www.ecoradio.org and sign up for our email list. Those of you on Facebook, please like our page. We're at WBAI Ecologic, no dashes.
WBAI is community radio, and there's lots of ways to get involved. And, of course, we always need your donations. We need your contributions to support everything that makes a broadcast happen. The engineers, electricity, those are the electrons around those atoms, equipment upkeep, rent. Pledging as a BAI buddy now during this show really helps Ecologic especially.
We are always glad to have you with us for Ecologic, live or on the archives. If you listen live, we may be able to take your call and answer your question. This show will be on the WBAI archives in just 5 or 10 minutes.
Our thanks to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins. We couldn't do this without you. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. Sally will be back next week. Join us next Wednesday, October 4th at 10 a.m. to hear about fascinating animals. Join our website for details. Thanks for being our listeners, and remember to vote.
See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth.
Solar power, inexpensive energy.
I'm David Saltman, running for a seat on WBAI's local station board. I've been a broadcast and journalism professional for 50 years. I'm the guy who discovered Gilda Radner and was first to put her on the air. I've been a producer for Charles Kirol on CBS, for Diane Sawyer on ABC, executive producer of documentaries for Ted Turner's CNN, and done 18 hours on PBS. I've raised millions of dollars in public broadcast funding. You can read more about me in Wikipedia. I've been a big fan of WBAI and Pacifica, and it's a crime what's happened there. Vote for me to save and restore one of New York's great institutions. This is David Saltman, running for a seat on WBAI's local station board.
I'm Tessa Lena, and my platform is Letting People Speak. I think it's very important to let people express their own opinions and share what they actually think based on their own lives and experiences. See, I grew up in the Soviet Union. I was a child in the USSR, and I know what it's like when people don't have this opportunity. So I really hope that we don't end up with the same here. And seeing what's happening around, I want to do my part to ensure that it doesn't happen. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
My name is Charles Njereka. I am running for a seat on WBAI's local station board. I intend to bring to bear my experience in community organizing and community resource mobilization to turn around the fortunes of WBAI. I represent the views and perspectives of the African listening public that are unrepresented and at times underrepresented. I'll bring my experience in resource economics, and law and policy to bear so that we can change the fortune of WBAI. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Neil Voss, and I am a candidate for a position on the WBAI local station board. I am currently chair of the WBAI Community Advisory Board, and I have been a WBAI CAB member since about 2012. My financial support for WBAI goes back to the early 1980s, and more financial support is what WBAI needs now. Strategies need to be developed to increase listeners, and WBAI needs to turn listeners into members who financially support the station. This is Neil Voss, and please vote for me.
Hi, I am Guy Van Tresca, a candidate for the local station board of WBAI, a native New Yorker, originally from Brooklyn, currently living in Manhattan. I work as a natural health consultant. I've been a student of history most of my life, from ancient times to today. During the Cold War, I served as a U.S. Army officer in Germany, then spent 20 years in the IT industry, most of it supporting federal government agencies. My personal experience has shown me how humans organize their structures of wealth and power. One way to keep those power structures accountable is through media, the fourth estate. I would like to see WBAI return to its investigative journalism roots and to report the voices that are ignored by corporate-owned mass media. Please support me in this endeavor. Thank you.
Hi, this is Joan DiLorenzo, and I'm running for a seat on WBAI's local station board to save BAI and keep it from being shut down. We need free speech community radio more than ever now, with street news and more programming that reflects the diversity of the community. I'm asking everyone, young and older, let's all work together to bring in new ideas that will better serve the people and the station. Financial transparency is very critical. Email me your thoughts at JONIE, the number.